Hello and welcome to Should Have Listened to My Mother. I'm Jackie Tantillo. I'm your host. On this podcast, we talk about the influences that our mom had or didn't have on us and the kind of path that we took. And are we the person we are today because of her positive influences or her negative influence on our life, on our lifestyle, who we are? Did your mother or does your mother have an influence on who you are maybe as a parent? My guest today is Peggy Robinson. Welcome, Peggy, to Should Have Listened to My Mother. Peggy Robinson, originally from Northport, Long Island, and now lives in California because she works in film and TV production. And you have been working really hard for a really, really long time. That takes real dedication.
That's true. I definitely, I always say, like, when you start at the bottom, you know you started at the bottom.
You have to start somewhere, right? So just to give you an idea of where we, after all these years of Peggy working, not the bottom, but in her beginning years, the Academy Awards gave many awards out to feature film that kind of blew everybody away. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. You were the production supervisor, right?
That's correct. Yep.
With Frances McDormand, yep. Sam Rockwell, Woody Harrelson, just to name a few. And we also, I was talking to Peggy earlier and I said, I only worked on Godzilla, the movie Godzilla in the 90s in Lower Manhattan by the old Fulton Fish Market, because I wanted to be able to spend time with her and work with her. I was doing some acting and I figured a day on a feature film can't hurt. And it was scary. It was scary because the taxi cabs were flying by and we all had to pretend and act that Godzilla was coming toward us, coming right at us at the fish market. So fish were flying everywhere and the containers of ice and the taxi cabs. And there's hundreds of people
in the cars. Yeah. And the cars were thumping because the special effects guys put thumpers in them. So they would like jump up and down to look like Godzilla.
It helped with your acting, your method acting.
Right.
You worked on Last of the Mohicans. Oh my gosh, your production list is endless. Production manager, supervisor, TV series, documentaries. You've kind of done it all. But now that we kind of have an idea of who you are, work-wise, I would love to find out more about who you are, maybe because of your mom or in spite of your mom.
Boy, I did listen to my mother. I listened to her. I listened to my mom and then went on to discover where my mom had come from that I didn't quite know earlier on in life. So my mom was left on a New York City subway as an infant. She was a foundling in 1933 in the winter, February 10th. Snowstorm, and someone found her and brought her to an adoption agency, and her name was Alice Peck. And then she was adopted by her parents, who named her Jean Marie after some chef. And she she didn't really reveal that to me when I was younger. It took well into my 20s to figure out that sort of all my cousins weren't really related to me, which I sort of knew instinctively. Like the once a year that we would see them, I'd say, these are definitely not my people. We do not share DNA.
Wow. So she never came out and told you specifically? You kind of pieced this all together and then you brought it up to your mom?
Yeah, I mean, like she was the only one that could tell that story, but then I really nailed her down on it. And most recently, I found a piece of jewelry. It's a gold. She was in the antique business, so she had a lot of Victorian jewelry. But she had one charm bracelet that had a charm on it. It was a pin, actually, but she attached it to the bracelet, and it said Queen of Truth. And she was actually a young mason, and I had no idea. And I went online, and, you know, it was in Long Island, and I searched it, and it had her listed in there. I think it was 1947. My memory isn't completely solid.
It had your mom? Your mom's mom?
Yeah,
mom?
It was my mom. She was a young mason. I think it's called the Eastern Daughters of the Eastern Star.
Oh.
And Yeah, and they listed her as the Queen of Truth, and I always thought it was ironic that someone who didn't really know the truth about her own life had been given this 14-karat gold charm that had the sign of the Masonic Lodge on it, and that she, in fact, had been a Mason. Now, that she never told me. I only found it out by looking at her charm bracelet and being more curious about it. Actually, it wasn't a pin. It's a triangle with a little hammer next to it.
Ah, it's their symbol. That's the symbol.
I was doing a TV show called Lodge 49 about a fraternal order. And suddenly, like, my life was filled with a lot of Masonic information because of this job I was doing.
Wow.
It hasn't released yet. It's an AMC job. My mom, I had to sort of try and make up who she might have been or who might have left her behind. It might have been, a friend said to me, well, your mom's mom had more than a bad day, the day that she left her behind. And I thought, well, that's curious. And then I thought, what if it was like a good thing that she was left behind? It was warm where they left her, and, you know, it was freezing outside, because I've done my research, because I tried to write a story about how she may have come into the world, because it's fun to imagine, you know, both sides or any side, like many stories, right? So she didn't know either. So so that was interesting to me, and I learned a lot by trying to envision the different ways in which she could have come into the world.
Do you know if she ever tried to find out who her parents were? Or there's no way to...
She was very practical. I mean, her motto... And this isn't what I was thinking earlier about telling you what I might have learned from my mother, but her one solid motto for herself was, it was never told to me like you do this, but she would always say, oh, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get on with it. That's what I always say. Like, that was my mom's motto. Like, get on with it. She would say, like, what am I going to do, sit in, like, a circle with a bunch of people and talk about myself? Like, she was like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I know, and I think of the irony now of all of that. But her, you know, her advice to me was probably, I think she was probably afraid of me on some level because I was such a strong-willed person. I don't think she was thinking, like, oh, I've got all the wisdom in the world. But the one thing she did say to me, because she always... I've always worked for her in her antique shop from a super young age, and I would sort of fall in love with different pieces of jewelry, and she kind of couldn't say no to me, which is sort of called being spoiled in some level. And so I had a lot of her jewelry, and she would always say, now check your prongs.
Wow.
So,
what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, checking your prongs meant that check your stones in your ring to make sure that they're being secured by...
Oh, I understand. I thought there was another meeting about, like, get your act together or something like that. Like,
well, no,
dot your I's and cross your T's.
Well, and that's what's so interesting is that she told me to check my prongs, which she meant literally, and through my life, it's been a complete metaphor for safety, for mindfulness, for tracking value, right? Because here you have the prongs of your ring holding onto your gems or your stones, and you don't want them to loosen and get away.
Oh, my goodness. I feel like I know her just by knowing you.
I know. So, yeah, I'm blabbing away here. But even though there were sparse, you know, sort of sparse moments of... I'm going to, you know, hand you off a bunch of wisdom. She never came at me with that. She just dropped a couple of zingers, and I've managed to recycle them.
You have this ability to come up with these these liners that are exactly what you're talking about. And I'm like, where did she learn this stuff? It's like a whole new language, and it is so fitting for your personality because you are so unique, and in that you don't fit in a mold, Peg. Your family has this beautiful farm in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, where you and Steph got married, and you've you've been around, you know, you're very wise, an old soul in a very good way. And look what your mom, the influence that she had on your life clearly comes through what you know and don't know, right?
I like to get to the bottom of things, and I think he probably would have been bowled over by my need to know. I mean, I can't imagine having discovered all these things while she was still alive. I would have just locked elbows with her and gone like, come on, we have to go on an expedition. We need to figure all this out. And then the sort of practicality of like, okay, no time to lament. Let's just get up and do it, or on to the next, you know? I mean, I suppose things could have been more precious to her, and she might have maybe suffered less in her, in like what her upbringing was. You know, she didn't have the greatest upbringing by the people who adopted her, but she was very adventurous, and that she didn't let that slow her down.
So, where did she grow up?
She grew up in Huntington, Long Island.
Okay, and does she have half siblings?
Well, she has a brother that was not related to her, so he was adopted as well, and he's no longer around. She doesn't have any living siblings. And then she had, the people who adopted her had their own child, biological child.
Okay.
And so we weren't related to them either. And so otherwise, so there's nobody, no. And that's where coming, you know, when I used to think about the people who we'd spend some Christmas, you know, Christmas Eve with, I would always say, you know, talk about instincts, right, and following them and going, these are not, there's no way I'm related to these people. It just didn't feel right. And I didn't always know that. And then when I knew it, it was like all the answers came to me. Like, oh, so I was right. Like, this is definitely, these are foreigners to me. And it's funny because, you know, my mom, I don't know whether she sought out her because they say that people want to know who their biological parents are. It's not okay. It's not enough just to be adopted, right? They're finding out now. They're sending, you know, Korean-American kids who were adopted. They're better off being with their parents than maybe coming to the United States where, you know, maybe someone could take care of them better, but they want to be reunited. So I don't know if my mom... I always feel like I'm obsessed with finding out information and origin, even though my mother wasn't, or didn't seem to be.
Maybe your mom, for a number of years, did struggle with it, but then she somehow got this gift to realize that it didn't matter, and that's when she became who she was. Instead of constantly trying to look back and trying to figure out and put the puzzle together, maybe she realized it didn't matter anymore because that's too hard. I mean, that's crushing, right? Struggling, trying to figure out why your mom or your dad or both left you on a subway in the middle of the winter?
I think so. I mean, no matter what the circumstances, whether it was a good solution, it has to... I mean, when I wrote about the moment when she literally left her mother's arms or whoever it was, this moment of just being, you know, detached, and no longer having protection, like all those things, right? Yeah. Whether they were doing it in a good way or a bad way, it still had to have been, you know, being abandoned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They may have left her because they knew they couldn't provide for her, right? So they were saving her life by giving her away, but that doesn't make it any easier for your mom, right?
Right, and she only could make up a story. She had to rely on, you know, I always say that, like, we all tell ourselves stories. It's the stories we choose to tell ourselves, right? So she chose to tell herself a story or to not listen or to not consider the story and just move forward, and then had an antique shop and decided to live in the history of other people's artifacts. Who knows if that was ever part of an escape, you know? Cause she loved doing that. I mean, she didn't have a big world that revolved around herself, like taking care of herself. It was more about extending herself into a community and caring for other people. So, yeah, she wouldn't have made it in 2018, where we have this sort of preening culture, where everyone's, you know, getting their nails done and going to the spa and doing all these things. It's self-serving. She always was always caring for other people and trying to do things for other people.
And in her shop especially, admiring and being completely compelled to pass on these gems and jewels and these treasures of people that maybe have passed away as well, right? She was trying to continue this legacy of things that she found so much beauty and charm in.
Yeah, she enjoyed it so much. And, you know, it's funny, when she found out she had lung cancer, we went on a buying trip up in Rhinebeck, and we would both hunt for, and we'd find the same quirky, weird stuff, and we'd both end up, pointing at the same thing in a case. Like, we both found a ring that had, like, a child's tooth on it, set into a ring, and we were both like, oh, that's so cool. And I thought, oh, my God, like, I'm so at it. Like, I'm so part of you. Like,
big seller on eBay.
Well, this is way before eBay. This is like 1993.
No, I know.
But we would just totally gravitate towards the same weird stuff. So, you know. And, yeah, so like somehow I'm carrying my mom around in a big way. But with very little advice, but lots of showing me that you do things for a community and you extend yourself and you bake and you cook and you care. But
I am speaking with Peggy Robinson. You're listening to the Should Have Listened to My Mother podcast, and we're talking about a relationship with our moms. And you are a phenomenal cook. You have a knack for making your home so unique and interesting with all the different things that you collect. You knit. Tell us some of those stories about the wool that you used to, and the angora that you used to collect and dye, because I have vivid memories of all of those stories.
Well, I somehow, I lived in the Pacific Northwest, and I bought a spinning wheel, but I didn't have anything to spin, and we had helped a neighbor named Mrs. Savage move the cab off of her pickup truck, and she paid us $15, and we went to the farmer's market, and I bought a rabbit and named it Mrs. Savage for $15, and that started us buying a lot of Angora rabbits and learning how to spin, going right from zero to Angora, which usually you spin a lot of sheep wool in between. Anyway, and then I would spin some weighted dog hair for a family who had collected it, and then I'd make them hats, and I was in contact with this man in Australia who was the world's largest colored sheep breeder, and we were like pen pals to each other, and I would order my wool from him in Australia, and then I probably dropped it for maybe 10 years or so, and I picked it up again and when I was in New York City, and even when Stefan and I got married, I went and found fleeces from this one breeder of Corriedale sheep and made our wedding sweaters. I spun I prepared both fleeces from being in the grease and combed all the wool and spun it, and my friends knit the sweater, and I knit a double helix DNA cable up the backs of both sweaters, and I just tried to incorporate our, you know, what we do in our lives into continuing it, you know, just embedding it deeper.
Peggy mentioned knitting these sweaters for their wedding. Can you describe for our listeners, Peg, what the farm is like in Cape Breton? But just give us a little brief idea of the setup and the landscape.
Okay, so it's my parents bought it was a sheep farm in 1965, 195 acres on the ocean. They kind of had narrow strips along the sea in Cape Breton because the Queen's mandate, I guess, was to make sure everyone had access to the water, because so much of what people did for a living was on the water. So the properties are very narrow. So Stefan and I, not wanting to be big on, having a New York City wedding, we thought, oh, well, let's go to the farm. That'll cut down on the number of people who are going to show up. And we did kind of everything from scratch. Put up two big tents because the Maritimes are always kind of rainy and foggy. We didn't know what the weather was going to be. Got a couple of horses and locals who, you know, agreed to lend us their horses and ride up from the beach together while everyone, and we were like, who's going to marry us? And we thought, I wanted a sea captain and a scientist. I wanted all these people. And we found a woman who did a Shambhala ceremony because she said that she recognized how community-oriented we were. So she decided to marry us according to a Shambhala paradigm. Anyway, so many people came. There were like 120 people there. I kept looking out the door and going, oh, they didn't RSVP, but that's good. Here they are.
Oh,
and people
goodness.
Slept on the beach. They slept in the house. They slept in all the little cabins around town. And
slept on the blueberries, the wild blueberries. You just lie on the ground eating wild blueberries. It was pretty spectacular.
That was such a good season. I think it was Labor Day because we always celebrated as Labor Day and not the date, just the Sunday of Labor Day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
We had my friend who's a fisherman bring us crab, and people made crab cakes, and we had smoked salmon locally made by this German couple that came from Germany and started a smokehouse. We just made the food for it and had a big bonfire on the beach. It was a great weekend.
It was pretty
good. We woke up the next day and said, let's do it again.
Good, you can renew your vows.
I know.
And we'll all come back. Yeah. So I want to ask you a question. Who are you? Who are you, Peggy Robinson?
I think I am such a sum of everyone. You know what I said the other day in at work, and I didn't expect to answer this way, but we had this really interesting man from who was a Cajun guy, an older chap, maybe in his early 70s, and he was such a character, and he came into the office, and we had such a great rapport, and when he left, the girls in the office said, oh, you found your soulmate. And I said, isn't it our job to find our soulmate in everybody? A little bit of our soulmate in everybody? Because my husband's my soulmate, but they just recognized this banter and rapport that we had between us. And so for me, who I am is like a sum of who I am when I relate to people with love and honesty. And I know it sounds so cheesy, but it's who I am when I get to mix with with everybody.
Like minds and unlike minds?
Yeah, like it's our job to connect to people. So for me, I'm just a sum of who I connect to and who we all gather along the way. So I don't ever want to be one thing that stops. I always hope that who I am is just continues to be the sum of everything that I gather as I go. I try to just have 10 pairs of the same Levi's and maybe some gray, brown, and blue shirts, and so I got that covered, and then I go out into the world and hope to connect with people.
Oh my gosh.
All the decorative stuff get in the way. I just want, I like live to bond. It's kind of like it's a real thing. I don't know. I don't know where it comes from, but in search of yourself through others, I don't know if that is, but you have to start out with something solid and something genuine or some kind of truth.
Your mom.
The queen of truth. Like, it's so interesting. And, you know, one other thing that I realized when I was looking at all fraternal order stuff is this foundation of fellowship. And fellowship is something that I try really hard to carry within myself, because when you reach out to others with that, you then create more and you join. So I think after the fact, learning about my mom's affiliation with a fraternal order and in the name of creating fellowship and community and the common good, I think more and more that's, I look back and I think, I might be a little obsessed with that. I might be a little obsessed with finding a little bit of myself in other people, which is, you know, what we have to do in order to live as communities and not break apart.
I agree wholeheartedly, my dear. I couldn't have said it better. And I know that your mom is very, very proud of you.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, I think she was happy. She had two pretty good kids.
Two really good kids, because she was amazing. So, did you listen to your mother?
I think I recognized my mother. I think I listened, and I think it was only the echoes of my mother that reminded me that I listened to her. Because in the moment, when you're growing up, you are learning how to be with and separate from and grow up, right? So you just, but it's the things you hear after the fact that you realize you're still listening to your mother. Like, I'd be fresh to her, and she'd say, you talk to your friends like that?
She's a smart
cookie. So I'd say,
yeah, I know.
She made me look back on myself and decide, like, oh, familiarity should not breed
contempt.
or like frayed respect. So yes, I would have to say, I mean, I literally, yeah, I call her into action all the time, probably way more than I ever would have expected. Yeah.
I think she's very happy to do that, and I do the same. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Can't thank you enough, Peg. Peggy Robinson.
Oh, well, thank you.
These stories are the best. They're just the best. They keep getting better. And I've got another one to share with you now. Our next guest is waiting on the phone, and she's got a great gift to put pen to paper.
It's something that I think about a lot because in my perspective, it gives us additional freedom. If you are able to express yourself orally, how you feel, vocalize how you feel. But in life, to be able to sit down and write something and get your point across is such a wow kind of thing to me. I mean, you think of all the different styles of writing in the world, whether you're a journalist or storyteller, each form is different. My next guest is a wonderful writer, and I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Bridget Brown. Welcome, Bridget.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Brown, and we'll go into this a little bit, but she's doctor, obviously, so she's got a master's, she's got a PhD. She studied at Muhlenberg College. She taught at Muhlenberg. Her master's was from William and Mary College, and her PhD is from NYU. So she certainly has credentials. So I want to kind of pick your brain, Bridget. We'll talk about your career and your family life. And then, of course, we want to talk about your mom, because we are talking about Should Have Listened to My Mother. And I want to find out if you did listen to your mom or not.
Yes, I did. For the most part, yes.
Did you always know you wanted to be a writer? Did you sit down at your kitchen table and do your homework? Do you keep a diary? Were you one of those kind of kids?
Not really. And
I wasn't at all.
No, nor was I. I have some very kind of embarrassing to read little journals from high school, but I wasn't a religious diary writer at all. I never wrote fiction, and I still haven't written fiction, so I'm not sure. I always liked school. I liked school. Maybe that.
Did you read a lot growing up?
Yes, I loved reading, and I love reading. I did always read a lot, so that's probably a piece of it.
You are now, you're a professor of writing at Montclair State University in New Jersey.
That's right.
What, and is it creative writing? What is it, writing studies?
No, there is a writing studies department now at Montclair, which is great, but I teach college writing. So most colleges still have a writing requirement for kids, and at Montclair it's a 2-semester sequence, College Writing 1 and College Writing 2. And it's expository writing, it's essay writing.
Do you think that the students are interested in writing? Do they think it's an important craft?
You know, I think they sort of have been told it's important. So I guess they, most of them think it's important. Do they enjoy it? You know, a handful of them probably enjoy it. It's mandatory, you know, so you really get the cross-section.
But they seem to like you because you can, you know, you rate your professors now.
Oh, God.
So you're rating.
Oh, God.
You're a tough grader.
That's terrifying.
gives good feedback. A tough grader gives good feedback. Lots of homework. I can't believe they do this now for professors. So kids go online and they just pick the professors that grade very easily and don't give a lot of work. It's kind of silly.
Yeah, it's hideous. I stopped looking at Rate My Professor a couple of years ago because it was too distressing. It was too upsetting.
Tell me what it was like growing up. What was your mom like? Are you who you are today because of your mom or in spite of your mom?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would say that for the most part, I'm who I am because of my mom, but not the career piece, right? So that's an interesting complexity to think about. I think she was not a career woman. She didn't even go to college, right? She went to a commercial high school in Brooklyn. That's sort of what one did when you were young, kind of, you know, she's sort of Irish-American, Irish-Catholic, living in Brooklyn. She had three older brothers. They all went to college and became kind of executives, and she was sent to a commercial high school to become a secretary, you know, so she was a secretary. And she did work in my life, but she didn't identify with the work, especially as far as I know.
What is your mom's name?
Oh, Mary. She was Mary, yeah. Her maiden name was Chave, C-H-A-V-E, which is kind of an unusual name, but and then Mary Brown. And she had jobs, you know, when we were growing up. She went back to work when I was about 11, I guess, to start making a little more money to send us to college. But she didn't seem to like them very much. So I did not have a career, I didn't have a career role model in my mother. I had a kind of a human being role model.
Was she a love model?
Yeah, exactly. No, absolutely. And I have a very clear memory of asking her once, like, what her favorite job was out of all the jobs she had had, and she said that it was taking care of us. I think of that a lot now, and I'm like, what do I make of that? Is that good?
It's really
Is
hard.
That bad?
It's really hard, right? I'm obviously the lifestyle, life in general was different, but still, just taking care of your children. And that's the most, probably the least rewarded, but the most important, just to have a positive mother figure in one's life.
Yeah, and I do think I know my father was angry at her family for not sending her to college. He had an axe to grind with the in-laws about that. But
anything that you've passed on from your mom as far as raising your children that you've passed on to your children? Like you can say, oh my gosh, my mother used to say that.
I think so. I mean, I just think my whole way of kind of being with my kids is a lot like she was with us. I don't know. She was a lovely person. She was probably a bit calmer and more gentle than I am with us. But, you know what I mean? I don't think I would have had three children if I hadn't had a mother like her who enjoyed children. She enjoyed us. She enjoyed having children. She enjoyed being with us, spending time with us. So I think that basic choice of having them, you know, and trying to spend as much time with them as I can was, because I don't, you know, with a doctorate, so I have this job teaching writing, but this is not a tenure-track job in American Studies, right, which is what I theoretically had been trained to get. And I did one job search after I got my doctorate for that kind of job, and there, or maybe 2 years, I went on the job market, and there aren't a lot of jobs in American Studies, you know, tenure-track jobs. And when they exist, they often require you to kind of go somewhere far away. You know, oh, there's three jobs this year. One's in Hawaii, one's in State College, Pennsylvania, and one's in, you know, Norman, Oklahoma, or something like that. So I pulled back pretty quickly on that kind of academic job search because I wanted to focus on having kids, and I sort of wanted to be in this area near my family. Now, my mother was dead at that point, but my father was alive, my sisters are here, and I wanted to be kind of rooted to them. So that's all from my mother, I think. You know, so some people would view that as, you know, I mean, it was not the best choice from a pure career ambition perspective, but it was the right choice for me, and it's worked out well, you know, because I enjoy teaching writing. It's not what I was trained to do in grad school.
Now your eldest is getting ready to look at colleges, as my younger one is. Are you recommending parameters of any sort to stay nearby, or they can go wherever they want? Or were you given parameters when you decided to apply to schools?
I was given parameters, and I resented them horribly. I was given a 3-hour radius. I remember I wanted to go. I had an idea that I wanted to go to Bowdoin in Maine. I'm not sure why. And my father said, absolutely not. you know, we're not going to be driving 8 hours in the middle of the night if you're sick or something like that.
He's a smart guy, Bridget.
So we haven't really placed, I'm hoping he doesn't. So far, of the places he's looking at, there's one that's on the West Coast. I don't even really want him to apply there because I would, if he gets in, I don't really want him to go there because for that reason, you know. I mean, I figure if they're going to give him a free ride, then he can go there and I can afford to fly back and forth, but otherwise, no. There were a lot of restrictions and rules, and so I think I'm a little bit in the other direction as a reaction to that. You know, I think my mother was, kind of a gentler parent. She was a little more laid back. And I can only imagine she was just so thrilled that we were all going to college, and, you know, which she hadn't been able to do, you know.
Did she resent that she didn't get to go to school?
She didn't seem to. She never voiced that if she did. But as I said, my father resented it for her. He was mad about that on her behalf.
Was she a cook, your mom?
She was a good cook of fairly simple food. You know, I thought she was a great cook when we were growing up. In hindsight, I realized it was very, you know, it was kind of meat and potatoes. You know, there was nothing kind of jazzy or ethnic.
I think that those hearty staple meals, there's something very comforting about them, right?
Absolutely.
Especially with three boys. They probably ate like crazy if they're like my boys.
Yeah. So I thought she was a good cook. She liked to bake more than she liked to cook. She was a really good baker, and she made really good pie and stuff like that. I remember she did a little after school enrichment for my elementary school. They had a series of them where we would go to people's houses where the parents would lead a little class in something they were interested in. They would never do now, probably, right, for purposes of litigation and stuff. But kids came to our house, and she did a little baking class, an enrichment class in baking. And I still can hear her when I'm cooking and baking. I can hear her directions and her instructions, and, you know.
Like what would she say?
Tips. Just today, actually, my son was baking today. And I was, you know, giving him little pointers, you know, like, you don't want to pack down the flour. Don't pack the flour. Be careful. You shake down sugar, but not flour. She used to say, don't be afraid of the, dough or the pastry. You're smarter than it is. One of her favorite things. You can't be afraid of it.
Is so cool.
It has no intelligence. You're smarter than it is. You'll figure it out.
Oh, that is brilliant.
Yeah.
But I don't bake much because then I wind up eating it. So, but especially when it comes to things like the dough or the pastry, the shell, it's like if you over knead it or you over roll it, then it's not as flaky and light,
exactly.
Is it? You know, so it's very intimidating. It may not be smart, but it's very intimidating.
It is. And in fact, you know, baking is more kind of precise than cooking. But she seemed to just really enjoy doing it, you know. And I think all my sisters and I kind of took that from her. We all enjoy getting ready for like a holiday or something like that because we remember how much she liked that.
What are some words to describe her? Her personality?
She is, I mean, I've said gentle a few times. She was an interesting person. She was kind of had a dry wit. She was a quiet person. You know, she's more introverted than I am. But she was very funny and observant. I think of her as being very kind of kind and sweet and those things. But I remember when she died, the priest from their church, from our church, who was a friend of our family, was a great guy. I said something like that to him, like, "Oh, she was such a good person." He said, "You know, but you don't mischaracterize your mother. She was very tough." I said, "Really? How so?" And he said, "Oh, when I came to this town, she raked me over the coals." Would I be a priest who was going to be helping people in the most need? Would I be helping those in poverty in the community? Or would I just be, you know, taking advantage of my position of power in the church and all this?
Oh, I love that.
And I thought that was great. So she was someone who was not, you wouldn't have known that about her, right? She was not a showy person or a, she's not someone you would have known necessarily had those opinions, but she certainly had them. And I love that he told me that. You know, he was like, don't underestimate her. She was very tough. She had a tough kind of quietness.
That Irish Mary.
Yeah. An iron butterfly, as they sometimes say.
Thank you so much. We have been talking with Dr. Bridget Brown, who is a writer. Oh, my gosh, we didn't even talk about your book. Can I mention it?
Sure.
She's the author of They Know Us Better Than We Know Ourselves, The History and Politics of Alien Abduction. Tell me a little bit about how you got into that.
Oh, yes. It's a crazy... I had never have a really good answer for that. I came out of writing at William & Mary. I was interested in reading and writing. I focused on kind of narratives about slavery. So actual slave narratives written by slaves and freed slaves. And then more broadly, fiction about slavery written by by white women who were slave owners. So then when I got into my program at NYU, I think just out of interest, I've always been interested in weird, all sorts of New Age stuff, astrology, palmistry, tarot, things like that. And I started reading these alien abduction narratives, which were very popular in the early 90s. And I was reading them just for pleasure, and they reminded me so, they were discursively, had many similarities with these other types of slave narratives that I had read. So that's sort of what started my interest in it. And then it moved rapidly from that connection into just a kind of, interviewing people who had been, thought they'd been abducted and stuff like that. So it's all, so again, it's a more anthropological kind of treatment of the topic. Ultimately.
That's like life-changing, listening to these stories. I can't even imagine how fascinating that is. They were abducted. Oh my goodness. Dr. Bridget Brown. You've been listening to Should Have Listened to My Mother. I'm your host, Jackie Tantillo, and we'll see you next time.